Hey, this is John Harcher, and welcome to episode 2 of Keep On Groovin', where I'll be looking at the legacy of Jimi Hendrix through the recordings that have come out in the 50 plus years since his passing. If you like what you've been hearing, please remember to hit the subscribe button. Right now it's available on Spotify and Apple, hoping to get on Google soon, hopefully more to follow. Today, we'll be talking about the live releases that came out during his lifetime and the ones that came out right after his passing. Episode 2, The Mike Jeffrey Era, 1970-1972, Live. Jimi Hendrix's studio albums were one kind of, no pun intended, experience, but seeing him live was something else altogether. Having spent his formative years on the Southern concert route of small R&B venues known as the Chitlin Circuit, playing with everyone from Little Richard, the Isley Brothers, and King Curtis, Jimmy learned how to play tight rhythms and tasteful leads where he could. He also learned how to put on a show. This is part of what impressed Linda Keith and later Chaz Chandler when they saw him playing in the Village in 1966. Then when the Experience got on stage, they made a big mark on the London scene. Probably the most famous appearance was right before the band left for the U.S. to play the Monterey Pop Festival. Sgt. Pepper had just come out a few days earlier, and at the Savile Theater, with some of the Beatles in attendance, he did something they never did. Opened his show with Sgt. Pepper's. Paul still talks about it to this day. Just ask him. Or tell him to stop already. Every time he gets a chance. With the UK enthralled, it was time to take over the US. They hit the stage at the Monterey Pop Festival, given the unenviable task of having to follow The who just destroyed their equipment at the end of My Generation. After he lost the coin toss backstage, he went to Pete Townsend and said, "Dig, if I got to follow you, I'm pulling out all the stops." Jimmy kept his word, playing behind his back, behind his head, with his teeth, and of course that little moment at the end of Wild Thing that lit the world on fire. Well, at least his guitar. From there and over the next 2 years, the Experience became a major concert draw in both the U.S. and Europe. In the 1960s, live albums weren't really a big thing yet for rock and roll acts. Mainly they were for blues, jazz, and R&B acts, and Johnny Cash famously did a few of his own behind bars. Ironically, Jimmy's first live album could have been one he recorded with Curtis Knight and the Squires in lovely Hackensack, New Jersey, the day after Christmas in 1965. But it sat in the vaults until Jimmy became Marketable Jimmy, and producer Ed Chalpin realized that these recordings he had with him were a veritable gold mine. And to think he got Jimmy to sign the contract and just had to pay him a whole dollar. Chalpin put out 2 albums worth of Curtis Knight material in late 1967 and 68, then took Jimmy to court charging breach of contract. The matter would be settled by giving Capitol Records an album to release. At that time, Reprise Records was also expecting another album from Hendrix, so the idea of a live album began to raise its head. Apart from radio broadcasts on the BBC and other European outlets, and of course Monterey, there wasn't much official live recording done until the Winterland run in October 1968. They recorded all 6 shows, but for some reason decided not to use them, and the tape sat in the vault until the 1980s. The February 24, 1969 concert at Royal Albert Hall was filmed and recorded, but ran into some legal issues that weren't resolved until, well, they still haven't been fully resolved 50 years later, but as we'll see, the material did come out here and there. Next up, the band recorded a couple of West Coast shows at the LA Forum in April and San Diego in May. Both of these shows were so good they made a concerted effort to put a live album to give to either Reprise or Capitol, most likely Reprise at this point. They mixed and prepared the following tracks. From Royal Albert Hall, Hear My Train of Comin', Little Wing, and possibly Foxy Lady. From the LA Forum, I Don't Live Today, Star Spangled Banner, Purple Haze. And then from San Diego, Red House, Purple Haze. I guess they wanted one without the Star Spangled Banner, have a choice. And possibly Fire. So had they gone with this, they could have had a 35 to 40 minute live album, depending which Purple Haze they decided to use, but they decided against it. They also thought about putting all the songs from Monterey out. The film Monterey Pop had come out around Christmas 1968, and Jimmy's flaming finale could be seen by audiences everywhere. They prepared a version with all the songs included, but out of order to try to balance out the sides. But in the end, that didn't happen either. One did come out later with about half the set. I'll get to that a little later in the show. Over the summer, of course, was the Woodstock Festival with Eddie Kramer doing the recording from a trailer off to the side. When Jimmy took to the stage with a 6-man band, it was basically him, Billy, Mitch, and occasionally Larry Lee that could be heard on the recordings. A lot of Juma Sultan's and Jerry Velez's percussion work, unfortunately, got lost in the ether. Next, we come to the Band of Gypsies concerts and album. This would be the one to go to Capitol over Chalpin's objections. He wanted an album from the Jimi Hendrix Experience, an entity that hadn't existed since the end of June 1969 and never would again. The band played two sets a night on December 31st, 1969 and January 1st, 1970. The first set each night generally avoided the well-known Experience songs and concentrated on newer material. The second sets had a lot of new material as well, but also had favorites like Purple Haze, Voodoo Child, Hey Joe, and even One Night Wild Thing. The album was put together after the band's ignoble end at Madison Square Garden at the end of January, where Jimmy was unable to perform either due to illness or, as some thought, being drugged. Mike Jeffrey fired Buddy Miles right there and then and wanted to get the Experience back together, but apart from one interview a few days later, it didn't happen. Jimmy and Eddie went into Juggy Studios to put the album together. They decided to stick with tracks from the January 1st shows only. I guess Jimmy felt the band wasn't up to par the first night, plus there were technical issues. Band of Gypsies. Side 1 opens with the first two songs from Set 1 on January 1st. Not really much to say about Who Knows. It's got an amazing groove set by Billy's bass riff. Jimmy goes off playing with his new Octavia guitar effect, and Buddy shows off his R&B roots with some scatting towards the end. A little goes a long way with Buddy. Jimmy broke a string towards the end, that's why he's playing a lot of lower end notes. They never really tried it in the studio, as far as I know, other than practicing it at Baggy's in December. Now, the other song on side one is far more important to the Hendrix catalog. Machine Gun is easily among Jimi Hendrix's greatest live performances. A later compilation album selected it alongside Wild Thing and the Star Spangled Banner, as the live performance is deemed essential. It started coming together over the summer. You can hear the opening of it in the version of Hear My Train A-Comin' at Woodstock. Just after the festival, he made his second appearance on the Dick Cavett Show with Billy, Mitch, and Juma as his band. They played a new song, Isabella, that segued into the opening parts of Machine Gun. During the recording session with Gypsy Sons and Rainbows, they tried the song twice. Both were loose, rambling sketches for ideas and laying down lyrics. The second version even mentions Isabella, which we'll talk about more when we get to War Heroes, probably next episode. Jimmy must have known Machine Gun was something special. It was one of three songs they played at all four Band of Gypsy shows. The first time was done back-to-back with Isabella, the other three it was on its own. The one they chose is the best of all four. Much like when he played the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock, Jimmy took his performance to another level and brought the other guys along with him. Billy's solid foundation and Buddy's thunderous drumming enabled Jimmy to transport his audience to the battlefields of Vietnam right there in the Fillmore East. He got sounds out of that guitar I'm not sure people were ever able to get again. There's a great line from Steve Vai about it that was in the MTV rockumentary way back in the day. You're listening to the guitar and it's screaming bloody murder, then you look at the video and he's just standing there. There was a black and white video that captured most of the first set, plus the color film of some of the second set from the previous night. And the black and white video does confirm what Steve says. Jimmy was just pretty much standing there. During the 1970s shows, Machine Gun made the set list the majority of the time, with Mitch giving the song a distinctively different vibe with his style of drumming. From all accounts, Jimmy never tried to record the song in the studio again. He must have felt he couldn't top the one he released on this album. All four songs on side two came from the second set on January 1st. In a pretty generous gesture, he let Buddy have two songs on the album. The first, Them Changes, was played at all four shows and became his signature song in no small part due to its appearance on this album. It's a good, solid, funky number that was assisted by Jimmy and Eddie's, shall we say, judicious editing. As I mentioned, a little Buddy can go a long way. His call and response jam towards the end of the song would sometimes go on and on and on and on, sometimes for 4 or 5 minutes. You know, a minute or so is good. After his time in the band of Gypsies, he would put out a solo album that had a studio version of the song with Billy Cox on fuzz bass. He would later be paid tribute by Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood, who did the song during the live shows in 2008 and 2009. The next two songs on the album are love songs, but only in the sense they both have love in the title. The album has the next song listed as Power to Love, but it's best known as Power of Soul. It's the third of the three songs that were played at all four shows. It's got a pretty long intro that delves into funkier territory than Jimmy had done up to now. In fact, it went on even longer, He did some editing on the open that cuts out Buddy's drum break and comes right back in with his yell before slapping the snare with both sticks. It's a later song, kind of surfacing in November under the title Crash Landing, you know, which had already been used, Jimmy, then under the name Paper Airplanes. He pretty much finished the song in January. Jimmy did some overdubs on the studio version and did a mix in early February. Then an Electric Lady, he went back and did another mix on August 22nd. The second love song is actually about love, sort of. Message of Love is also known as Message to Love. It started out as the other part of the jam with Earth Blues called Message from Nine to the Universe from May 1969. He opened his set at Woodstock with the song, which was then known as Message to the Universe, and then recorded a studio version of it with the big band during their sessions a few weeks later. With the band of Gypsies, he'd honed it down to a solid 4-minute song, though this version on the album goes out in like 5+. With the gospel-inspired background vocals, it still bore some resemblance to his sister song, Earth Blues. They did the song at both of the later shows, but not the earlier ones. It was a regular part of almost all the 1970 shows later on. Jimmy also did a mix of the pseudo version on August 22nd, but had already made the decision not to include either Message of Love or Power of Soul on his next album since they were just on this one. Maybe he'd put them aside for Rainbow Bridge or possibly for later use. The studio version of these last two songs would be released together on a later album, but they wouldn't make it out unscathed. The final song of the album is the last song of the final show before the encore, another one from Buddy, We Got to Live Together. Though it's actually more of a loose jam incorporating a riff from Sly Stone's Sing a Simple Song and another from Home Sweet Home. If Jimmy and Eddie did some judicious editing on changes, they just hacked the living daylights out of this one to get it under 6 minutes. The unedited live version runs a full 17 minutes long, and there's a lot of calls for hand clapping and foot stomping in there. I have to think this is the song that made Jimmy put his head in his hands and go, Buddy, will you please shut up? They played Buddy the short version, and he couldn't believe how good he sounded. They couldn't bring themselves to tell them they had to cut out 10 minutes to make it sound that good. I guess it was goodwill on Jimmy's part to give Buddy two songs on the album, and also a good way not to lose too much in the way of residuals to Capitol or Chalpin. It may have been a one-shot band to do this particular album, but it wouldn't be the last we'd hear from Band of Gypsies. Right around the time Band of Gypsies came out, the film Woodstock was released to theaters with Jimmy's prominently featured version of the Star-Spangled Banner closing out the film. The three-record soundtrack album came out a few weeks later, containing the Star-Spangled Banner, prefaced by the closing of Voodoo Child, then followed by Purple Haze, and ending with a slow tune listed on the album as instrumental, but later identified as Villanova Junction Blues. He recorded Villanova Junction several times in the studio in 1969, and independent of the film, was a semi-regular part of the setlist during 1970. So one of Jimmy's stellar live moments captured on film was available on record, but what about the first? This oversight would soon be addressed. On the same day as the opening party for Electric Lady Studios, August 26, 1970, Reprise released an album called, get this, Historic Performances, recorded at the Monterey International Pop Festival. Whew, God. It had one side of Otis Redding and one side of Jimi Hendrix. Redding performed 5 songs in his set, and all 5 made the LP. Jimmy performed 9 songs, and they picked 4, Like a Rolling Stone, Rock Me Baby, Can You See Me, and Wild Thing. I agree with Rolling Stone, Rock Me Baby, and Wild Thing. It's Can You See Me that I don't get. The song was one of 3 left off of the American release of Are You Experienced to make room for the 3 singles, Hey Joe, Purple Haze, and When Cries Mary. But that had been addressed with his appearance on the U.S. version of Smash Hits. And the song that started the album, Like a Rolling Stone, as done by Jimmy, isn't the rollicking set opener it would have been the way Dylan does it. Now, the song that should have opened the album wasn't heard by the public until 1984, though it reportedly ended up in a little scene documentary about a Little Richard concert sometime in like 1970 or so. I think Keys over on the message board was the one that tipped me off about it. After an introduction by Brian Jones, Jimmy opened his set with a blazing, sorry, no pun intended, version of Howlin' Wolf's Killin' Floor. Why the heck didn't they pick this song to open the side? The side was under 20 minutes as it is. You got to swap this out for Can You See Me, and it's only a minute longer. One of the many odd decisions over the decades when it came to Jimmy's catalog. Less than a month after the Monterey album was released, Jimi Hendrix died. By March 1971, Cry of Love had come out and was a great success. While Eddie Kramer and Mitch Mitchell and John Jansen worked on the Rainbow Bridge soundtrack, a number of other film-related projects were in motion, including several outside the sphere of Jeffrey's influence. First up was a two-record set, Woodstock 2, the sequel to the first soundtrack. This time, Jimmy got all of side one with three more songs from his set, two of them making their first appearance on record. Jam Back at the House has its origin when the band was getting ready for the festival and were jamming back at the house Jimmy had rented in the area in Shokan. Isabella makes its second appearance on record here. Like I said, we'll deal with it when we get to War Heroes, along with the previous song for that matter. The third on the side was Hear My Train A-Comin', under its other name, Get My Heart Back Together, beating the one on Rainbow Bridge to the punch by a couple of months. A soundtrack to the unreleased Royal Albert Hall film came out, but not on one of Jimi Hendrix's official labels. Ember Records released Experience in August of 1971, containing four performances from the film's February 24th show. An instrumental cover of Sunshine of Your Love, which was a concert staple for most of late 68 and early 69, the loose jam version of Room Full of Mirrors, a cover of Elmore James's Bleeding Heart, and a bit of noise entitled Smashing of the Amps. It was actually a piece to the Star Spangled Banner before Jimmy proceeded to do the aforementioned amp smashing to end the show. I've never really counted it as an official album since it wasn't done by Jimmy's team of people, be it Eddie Kramer, Alan Douglas, or whoever. But it wasn't a bootleg, so it's official in that sense. Now, about 6 months later, in February 1972, a second Royal Albert Hall album came out on the same label, imaginatively titled More Experience. It had Little Wing and Voodoo Child on side one, with Fire, Purple Haze, and Wild Thing on side two, a sequence that ended with the Smashing of the Amps from the first album. Then in a very strange decision, each of the sides ended with an edited version of a song from the first album, Room Full of Mirrors on side one and Bleeding Heart on side two. Now, why did this album start with Little Wing and Voodoo Child? Well, it turns out these songs had just been released from San Diego. More on that in a bit. In mid-September 1971, the concert film Jimmy Plays Berkeley was released. Though to call it a concert film is a little bit of a stretch. It contained various snippets of songs over the course of an hour, with four mostly complete numbers. Johnny Be Good, missing the intro, Star Spangled Banner, and Purple Haze came from the first set, where Jimmy had on this cool black outfit with the colorful vest and a headband looked really neat, and Voodoo Child from the second set, where he wore a powder puff blue sort of afghan that might have been worn later by Bea Arthur on Maud. My favorite section of the film is when a group of kids are protesting the fact that they actually had to pay to see the film Woodstock, and a guy confronts them, telling them he'd run over the legs if they didn't move. I think they wanted to make this guy look like some dumb redneck, but he actually comes across far more understanding than you think. He even tells them, your views are right, but what you're doing is wrong. So you'd think this would be the perfect opportunity to release a live album, right? Well, no. Eddie Kramer said at the time they couldn't find enough good material for a full album. Having listened to both sets as well as the rehearsals, I find it hard to contain the good material to just one album. Over the years, they sort of changed their minds, and a lot of the Berkeley material has been officially released, as Hear My Train A-Comin' would be on Rainbow Bridge a few weeks later, and then some other tracks on an album in a few months. The full second set came out in 2003 and upgraded from a better tape in 2012. We're still waiting for set one. Hopefully we get a nice box set somewhere along the way, but, you know, well, that time will come when it comes. Now, before we get to the album in a few months I just mentioned, another one snuck out, but just in Europe and right on the heels of Rainbow Bridge. This release took six songs performed at the Giant Festival on August 30th, 1970 at the Isle of Wight. Polydor producer Carlos Holmes did the selection and mixing duties, and I'm good with four of the six songs he chose for the album. Oddly enough, it's the first two I got the big problem with. Isle of Wight. To open it up, Holmes took a little snippet of the intro and edited it onto a 16-minute medley of Midnight Lightning and Foxy Lady. Like a number of Jimmy's other evolving songs, Midnight Lightning sort of existed in two places. This one took the music and some of the lyrics from Midnight Lightning and added in lyrics from another song called Keep on Groovin'. Sound familiar? He did similar lyric mashing of the songs as part of the ending of Voodoo Child at Berkeley, but with a lot more energy. As Midnight Lightning wound to a close, he starts a familiar intro to Foxy Lady. This one wasn't a quickie, however. It was a 9-minute steamroller that had security radio guesting over the amplifiers. An odd choice, but it certainly summed up the event. Loverman ends side one, making its debut 2 months before it was supposed to. I'll go into this song more later, but like the songs on Woodstock 2, this album got to release a song first before the regular guys, Eddie Mitch, John Jansen, got to put out the version they worked on. Following up on its debut on Cry of Love comes the live version of Freedom. It's pretty representative of the versions of the song performed that year. The music was generally tight, but Jimmy tended not to get the words 100% correct. But it was among the better songs performed that day, so it's a good inclusion. Plus, it still has that little section he edited out of the studio version of the breakdown jam that I referred to last episode. Now, despite it being Jimmy's biggest American hit, All on the Watchtower wasn't the big concert staple his earliest singles were. The experience performed it a couple times in 1969 in Europe, while it showed up a bit more frequently in 1970. He'd come up with a pretty good arrangement, you know, with the tremolo bars, you know, substituting for the slide guitar section. Now, the final song of the set begins with a short drum solo from Mitch that leads him into a fierce rendition of In From the Storm, the song that was barely 6 weeks old at the time. At the end of it, after Jimmy's farewell to the audience, the guitar falls over and makes a crashing sound, kind of eerily prescient. Like I said, this release was in Europe only, but Americans could also get their hands on some material from the Isle of Wight. A three-record set from CBS called, here's another long name, The First Great Rock Festivals of the 70s, Isle of Wight / Atlanta Pop Festival, also came out in 1971. It included a whole side of Jimmy from Isle of Wight, but oddly nothing from Atlanta, where he also played. And they did record, which we'll hear about later. The Midnight Lightning Foxy Lady Twofer made the cut, I don't know why, as well as Message of Love, here called Power to Love, which was possibly prepared for the Polydor LP but not used. Isle of Wight was a tough show. Jimmy was exhausted and technical problems plagued the set, but there are a number of highlights that will be released later on, as well as the full show in 2002. They could have done the full three-song opener, but I guess they didn't want to have two songs on the album when they had to pay royalties. A bit more of that opening, though, would show up soon enough. Hendrix in the West. I'm not sure what Mike Jeffrey was thinking, but a mere 3 months after Rainbow Bridge came out, Hendrix in the West dropped in January 1972. It's almost as if he took the 1969 live album and, you know, what could have been live at Berkeley and split the difference and then tried to pull a fast one. The title would make sense if he'd stuck to just using the San Diego and Berkeley shows and, you know, LA, but he didn't end up using that. We'll talk about more later. But of all things, the album starts out with the intro from the Isle of Wight Festival. Now, Isle of Wight may be west of Paris and Rome, but it's not what most people think of when they hear the West. It is a great intro, though, so I can see why they did it. Jimmy opened the set with a Star Spangled Banner style version of God Save the Queen, which then kicks into a quick version of Sgt. Pepper's, which may be why they passed it over for the Isle of Wight album. But unfortunately, as the opening riff to Spandau Castle Magic is clearly heard, the song fades out. Would have been nice to do all three, but we wouldn't get that for another, 30 years? Eesh. Anyway, next up, we get Little Wing from San Diego, which is odd because Little Wing wasn't played at San Diego. It's a little longer than the already short studio version, but the band is in great form. Surprisingly, the experience didn't do the song all that often. In fact, I think this might have been the last time it was done. It would have been great to hear him do the song with his 1970 gear set up with, you know, all the different Octavia pedals and the Univibe and all that. Would have been really cool. Side one ends with a 13-minute version of Red House, also from San Diego, which was actually played at San Diego. Much like Hear My Train A-Come on a Rainbow Bridge, this version is recognized as among the best Jimmy ever did. The song evolved into several different movements, including a great section where Jimmy kind of takes a quiet solo on his own while Mitch and Noel take a break before they all come thundering back for the finale. Now, side two kicks off with three songs from Berkeley, one from each set, if you include the rehearsals as a set. The first is Jimmy's killer version of Johnny B. Goode. If the crowd reacted with amazement to Marty McFly's version in Back to the Future, imagine if they'd seen this, especially the solo that he plays with his teeth. It's well known how much Dylan loved Hendrix's cover of All on the Watchtower. I kind of wonder what Chuck Berry thought of this version. Next up is Loverman, which, like Hear My Train A-Comin', was a concert staple, but was never released as a studio version when Jimmy was alive. and also ended up debuting on another album before the official one. Hendrix took the music from his arrangement of Rock Me Baby and just swapped out the lyrics. They did an instrumental version during the RU Experience sessions in April 1967, but didn't put either set of lyrics on it. The live versions in 1968 and 1969 tended to run about 5 or 6 minutes. They cut a version of TTG in October 1968 that was pretty representative of the song at the time. With the band Gypsies, he did a tighter 3-minute version, which introduced an ominous little walking section as a bridge. Some people think he's doing a nod to the Batman theme, but I just don't hear it that way. During the 1970 tours, he added Flight of the Bumblebee over top of the Batman section. This is the version he did at Berkeley and recorded Electric Lady in July. Not sure why that studio version didn't make it onto a posthumous release before the 2000 box set, unless they couldn't find it until then, which may not be out of the question. Next up is a loose jam version of Blue Suede Shoes that was recorded at the rehearsals earlier in the afternoon. It was actually a pretty comprehensive rehearsal. It was like almost 40 minutes long, and they did relative rarities like Roomful of Mirrors, Earth Blues, and Power of Soul. You know, it's fun to hear the band do Blue Suede Shoes kind of like this, you know, kind of loose, just kind of fun, but I'm not sure why you put this on the album in place of, you know, well, anything else, to be honest. The album ends with Voodoo Child from Berkeley. Well, no, it says San Diego, so it must be 1969. Jimmy had quickly turned this song into a concert staple, even before Electric Ladyland had even been released. It soon became the set finale for many of the shows from mid-1969 forward. Now, speaking of ending, the ending of this song does sound awfully like the start of Room Full of Mirrors from that Royal Albert Hall album over in Europe. Come to think of it, he played Little Wing at Royal Albert Hall too. Could it be possible we was misled? Well, as related in the book Setting the Record Straight, the story goes Eddie Kramer and John Jansen were putting In the West together. Mike Jeffrey walks in, drops some tapes on the table and says, "Use these." Since there was somewhat of a legal dispute at the time about the Royal Albert Hall tapes that continues kind of to this day, they asked what they were. Jeffrey's reply, "Don't worry, it's okay, use them." Hendrix in the West comes out, the lawsuit starts flying again, and the two engineers are now also named as well. This probably explains why those two songs ended up on the second Royal Albert Hall album that came out in mid-1972. Now, one other weird thing about this album, Polydor released it in Europe with side one as side two and vice versa. Why? You got me. Looking back in hindsight, it's easy to imagine that they could have put out any number of permutations of just the 1969 West Coast shows and the Berkeley concerts. In the West could have been a double album with one album from 1969, the other from 1970. They could have done a single album for each with the material from the LA shows being paired with San Diego and In the West. I think doing a double album for each would have been probably too repetitive for the 1972 market, but I really do think In the West should have been a double at least. Maybe in a later show we'll do some like fantasy albums or albums that, you know, they should have done. I'll actually be doing one or actually two of those on the next episode when we deal with War Heroes. So we finally got our Hendrix Live album, which hits the top 10 in England, reaches number 12 in the United States. Might be a good time to sit back, let the Rainbow Bridge movie get released, and see how things sort themselves out, which again is, of course, not what Jeffrey actually did. Next time, the Mike Jeffrey era comes to an end, and it looks like the end of the road for Jimi Hendrix as well. This episode is dedicated to a couple important people in my life. My dad liked to refer to himself as a fountain of useless information, yet, as my sister put it on a beautiful Facebook post after he passed, if you ever needed to know something about anything, you went straight to him. I guess I got that tendency passed down to me, which is why I can end up doing something like this, which is pouring a bunch of relatively useless information out for people to listen to. Thanks, Dad. I also have a friend who's going through some health issues right now. You know, Robin, we're all praying for you. Looking forward to seeing you and the husband soon. Take care. I'm John Hartjar. Thanks for listening.